This is the Misdirected Mark Podcast, a podcast about gaming, game mastering, and entertaining you, our listeners. We are explicit, and you have been warned, and I'd like to thank Mike Willard for letting us use his music on our show. Now let's pick up those mics and get on with this thing.
All right. Hey, so were you able to get your copy of Into the Iron Mountain?
I have it right here. It was buried with my convention stuff.
I actually have a copy of that. That thing is such a short print run. I only saw it like once when it was played back in the 80s.
I figured he had it. You've seen this game room. There's probably games hiding in there that he hasn't even seen in ages.
Right? No kidding.
I always wanted to play In the Iron Mountain. The Medusa encounter is supposed to be legendary.
My favorite encounter was always the Grand Hobgoblin Soiree. The rules for social encounters were something new for AD&D back then, and it was classic.
That's why I still run at conventions. People heard of the name. It's got a few short encounters you can make to a mini-adventure. Plus, it converts well to most game systems because there's very few battles.
I heard it fit well into other campaigns. They never did publish an entire world book for it, though.
Yeah, that's actually why I asked Jared to run it. I figured we could play test a few things, and then if we like the characters, we could flip it over into a full campaign.
Did it take long to convert it?
You already had notes on it.
I already had notes on it.
Then great. I'm looking forward to the adventure.
Oh man, it has been so long. I barely remember most of it, and it's just going to be fun to play some published D&D material again.
Nothing else. I like the charts.
I can't wait to roll on the random goblinoid pastry chart.
I'm wondering how difficult it will be to romance the Medusa.
I'm sure loving them is hard.
Aww.
And with that, welcome to the 406th episode of the Misdirected Mark Podcast. Tonight, we take a look at how to prep, publish adventures and resources. Then we'll chat along with the chat room for life while answering your questions. My name is Jerry.
My name is Phil.
And I, of course, am Old Man Logan.
Oh, man, that was a long way to go for that pun.
Thank you.
That was like the Hail Mary of puns. Like, run all the way downfield. I'm gonna hit you right on the 2-yard line. Boom.
You guys can blame me for that one.
We will.
All right. Before we enter the house misdirected, during these pandemic times, it's time to do a quick temperature check. See how we're feeling mentally and physically, and then we'll jump into one thing. So, Bob, tell me. How are you feeling?
I am not bad. I was a little tired this morning, which was just kind of a surprise because yesterday I was tired because I only got like 5 hours and a couple of minutes of sleep. But last night I got like just under 7, which was way more close to normal. And I was just dragging a little bit in the morning, the first thing, but took a couple of naps during the afternoon and naps are the bomb, man.
All right. So doing all right.
Welcome yeah. Doing all right. House. Yeah.
Cheer. Yeah. How you feeling physically and mentally?
Very good. Actually. Same as Bob. I've been getting more sleep lately. I've been trying not to stay up till 1-2 in the morning, except for tonight, obviously. And it's made a little bit of a difference getting an hour in here, an hour in there and actually feeling better. And today I just had one of those days when I managed to accomplish nothing big, but got literally 12 or 13 things off my desk. It just feels good.
All right. Welcome in. I had a shitty day at work. I think my only message on the Slack, I think I left 2 messages in the Slack room for life today. I think the first one was fuck this day. And then the second one was holy shit, it's only Tuesday.
Yeah.
Normally I don't feel that bad until a Thursday.
Yeah.
Especially if I go back and check my mood tracker. My mood tracker tells me I should usually feel this bad at work on a Thursday. So I was a little disappointed that it was Tuesday and I was feeling that angry about it. I will say this. I just barreled through my work. I was not happy, and I was not happy with my bosses and a few other things. I was not happy, and I just like barreled through my meetings. Like no BS, just kind of like got through them, finished out the day, jumped in the car, got myself a little Tim Hortons cold brew and a donut. Drove off my anger, came home, cooked some dinner, cleaned up the kitchen, then went for a bike ride right before I came down to get on the show. So I actually feel a lot better. I'm 13 out of 14 days riding my bike.
Nice.
Congratulations.
I only missed one because of rain. And I'm loving it. I'm having such a good time riding that, it really is the first exercise I've had in a while. Cause I did walk for a long time, but like, as I got heavier and gained weight back, and older, like walking tends to kind of wreck my ankle and my foot or whatever. And bike riding is like one surefire way that I can get good exercise, get my heart rate up nice and high. And I don't have any of the corresponding aches and pains. So I'm just like good to do it the next day. Like, and I've been riding like every couple of days, I've been making my route longer to build up some stamina. And I'm feeling great right now. I did not think I would be able to turn around such a crappy day at work into actually something where I was going to be cheerful. But I guess a little ride endorphins didn't hurt.
There you go.
That's nice. That's awesome.
So, yeah. Yeah.
All right.
I'm coming on in.
Whatever it takes.
Let's jump into the one thing. Jer, what's your one thing?
I finally got around to watching Knives Out.
Oh, I've always wanted to watch that.
Oh, just take the time to watch it. It's really well done. It's a fun Agatha Christie-esque murder mystery. It's got twists within twists and a ridiculous cast. Jamie Lee Curtis, Chris Evans, Ana de Armas, Daniel Craig, the bad guy from Superman. A bunch of others. It's a fun movie with a lot of twists and turns and mysteries, and it's a little bit like Clue and a little bit like Ocean's 11, and it's just a lot of fun.
Cool.
I would definitely recommend watching it if you like mysteries. So
cool. How about you, Bob?
I have been trying to ramp up my steps every day, walking around more, because I haven't been getting out and actually walking through the neighborhood, because when it's been warm out, I don't want to go out and friggin' sweat my cojones off. So there have been days, like typically on a Tuesday, I don't get a lot of steps in, and 2 weeks ago I think I only had like 1100 steps for the day. And for the longest time they say you should get 10,000 steps. My goal has always been 5,000, and if I get more than that, that's bonus land. And I haven't been hitting 5,000, so I changed the tracker on my Fitbit and said instead of shooting for 5, I want to shoot for 3. And I've been forcing myself to get up and walk around more. So when I get up and I do move around during the day, I do like a lap or two around the house, which isn't very much, but it's extra. And so I found myself today a couple of times going, oh man, I'm light. I'm not going to make 3,000 before the show. And so I'm getting up and I'm doing laps around the living room. A couple of times I got out
in the
backyard, walked to the back of the driveway, walked back.
I have to say that's one of the things I'm really enjoying about bike riding is that you go fast enough that like I'm not all sweaty as I'm riding.
Yeah.
I'm like sweaty the second we stop riding, right? Like as soon as we stop riding, I'm like all, you know, but whatever.
Yeah.
But I like that's the thing I like is I like the fact that like, you know, you speed up a little, catch some like breeze through, and it's starting to get really nice out. Like today was a really nice after dinner. It was a really nice temperature for a ride.
Yeah.
All right. That's Chair. That's Bob. Phil, I on Friday had a chance to run Hydro Hackers for the gang over at Metagamers Anonymous, Prismatic Tsunami. And they were fantastic. Nice. It'll come out in their AP, but you can actually also watch it. We streamed it live on Twitch, but it's also out on the YouTubes. And it's broken into two parts. The character creation is in one part and the actual gameplay is in another. And it was just like, okay, so I'm introvert, Phil. So months ago when they asked me, I was like, yeah, I'll totally run something for you. Cool. Let's put it on the books. And then like the week of it, I'm like, oh my God, why did I agree to run a game? Like what's wrong? Not that I didn't want to run for them, but like my total introvert is like, oh, why are you putting yourself out there, especially on a Friday after a long week? So anyway, I was like, I'm gonna go run this game and I'm gonna run it. So I think it came off pretty well. Senda said she watched it. She thought it came off. She thought it played really well. Players loved it, which is always my goal, right, is to just, like, let them have a good time. And they had never played a PBTA game before, so that was a lot of fun. Like, kind of teaching them PBTA and stuff. They took right to it. I knew they would. But totally, you can totally watch the whole thing on YouTube. So if you're like, can this Phil guy actually run a game? I don't know, but you can go take a look and find out for yourself. So anyway, it was a lot of fun. And actually it was a nice way to start off the weekend. I'm not introvert. Phil is still like, I don't want to run any more games online, but it was totally worth it. And I'm glad I did it. And I'm sure I'll do it again at some point. Awesome. I mean, I'm running for you guys, but that's different. You guys are like my peeps. So that you don't trigger my, my introvert thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. That's our one thing. A couple of announcements. If you are listening live tonight, the Deep Space Nine Watch Club commences with our first Deep Space Nine Watch Party, the two-part episode Emissary, which kicks off the series. We've got a long haul. We'll be doing this till February, folks.
Yep.
I am beyond excited. As much as I enjoyed Next Gen, Deep Space Nine is my jam.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I am so excited to share all of these episodes with you. So that kicks off tonight live. If you're listening live, so it kicks off on the 25th, right? Today's 25th? Yep. Mm-hmm. Kicks off on the 25th. And then we'll be going week after week. If you fall behind, you can always go to the forums. The lists for the episodes for each week are in there. You can just catch up or jump in whenever. We'd love to have you come join us. Mm-hmm. I also want to mention... I should mention a publication that just recently came out, Knucklebone Magazine. I'm going to get the link. We'll put it in the show notes for where to acquire said Knucklebone Magazine. But it is, it's actually been really enjoyable. It is, it's like a little like a tabletop RPG, almost like a scholarly journal. In fact, one of the articles in it, I think, is actually a scholarly journal article. But there's like a number of other reviews and other essays and things like that. And I spent some time reading it over the weekend and yesterday. Really enjoyed it. If you are into kind of a little more theory, like these weren't the kind of articles, at least in this issue, that were like 10 ways to level up your fighter, right? It was more like looking at RPGs as a procedural content generator, right? Nice. So a little more cool. Theory, a little more scholarly. I dug it a lot. So anyway, it's out now and you can totally get it. And I'm going to take 2 seconds, if you'll indulge me while we're live. Mm-hmm. I just want to look up and see if I have the person who put it together. Because I feel I did a very good job of everything else. John Harness is his name. He's the editor who put the whole thing together. I think he even laid it out himself. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a quarterly publication that offers reviews and discussion of analog role-playing games, just like I was saying. The next issue's theme is review. Reviews and second looks. The deadline for article pitches, so you can pitch an article to be in the journal, is September 18th. And you just have to send an email to knucklebonemag, all one word, mm-hmm. @gmail.com. We'll put that in the show notes as well.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it. Like my cool. RPG nerd, my RPG nerd got all excited as I was reading the article about procedural generated content. So got all nerdy on that. We'll probably, there's actually a couple of things I saw in that article that I actually want to tease out into potential shows at some point. So I'm sure we'll be talking more about it. Cool. All right. Those are our announcements.
Yay.
We are on to the feature segment, which is a workshop. So I'm just going to take a little sip here real quick.
Yeah, baby.
Do it.
Okay.
Do it.
Workshop. Prep and publish adventure. Go buy one at the store. Bring it home. Set it up so that it's the best for your group. You're going to have to do a little work even though somebody else wrote it. It's the workshop about prepping published adventures.
Those suck. So.
All right.
So last week, we were talking about prep and improv. We were just talking about published adventures and accessories. And in that discussion, we started a sidebar with many different ways to prep a published adventure. But just before hit critical mass, we decided to kick it off to its own topic. So tonight, we're going to look at some of the different ways you can be prepared adventures in your games. Before we start, I want to tell you that our discussion is really going to focus on good adventures. Everything we're going to talk about is diminished if the adventure is not good. So to keep things simple, we're going to keep focused on good adventures. But perhaps in a future topic, we can share ideas about what makes a good adventure and what makes a bad adventure.
Yeah. All right. With that, we are going to need some definitions. So,
behold, you are in the presence of Definition Panda.
I wish I could define good adventure. We may work on that to define it, but
that's
trust
not
me,
the focus of this week.
It's not, but but I'm glad you mentioned it, Jared, because when I was thinking about this topic, I'm like, yes, everything we're saying is true, provided that the adventure doesn't suck. If the adventure sucks, there's no, like, none of this matters anyway. You'll have to do twice as much work to salvage a shitty adventure. But there is no shortage of good adventures out in the world. So everything that we're telling you tonight is totally applicable. So let's talk about a couple of our definitions. Prep, we talked about last week, but by way of review, the work that you do before a session to be prepared to run said session. So whatever it is you need to do to kind of get your game ready to bring it to the table. Adventure. This is a plot for a game to be played at the table. Typically has a start, middle, and ending. It often follows some sort of literary structure, like my favorite, Freetag's Pyramid. And let's be honest, it's not every night you get to check off the Freetag's Pyramid box in your Misdirected Mark bingo card. So, special evening.
And now these adventures also go by other names. Scenarios, or if you're an old fart like me and Phil, module.
I still cannot let go of module. Module is the way I always learned it. It's the thing I used to bug my mom to take me to the store so I could pick up more of them.
There is something about getting those. I still have several like hard copies of the old TSR Gateway to Adventure manuals. Where you'd see, you know, modules being mentioned, you know, you'd see, oh, they're coming out with, you know, Vault of the Drow. And there's not even a picture for it yet. It's just a one sentence description of it in that really classic font. And it made us excited. And we got the adventures. And back then we were excited. And then we read them today and we're like, this needs some work.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Bar was much lower.
Yes.
There's some of them I've gone back and read and been like, this thing's a fucking meat grinder.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
What is it? White Plume Mountain.
Village of Hamlet, level one adventure.
Yes.
And there is a section where you're stuck between like 9 bugbears and 12 gnolls.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. Anyway.
There's some parts in Village of Hamlet that are in White Plume Mountain that are like that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so yeah, so scenario, this is one where I hate that there's like 10 different names for calling it this thing. We're going to try to use adventure, but since Jerry and I are, and Bob's older than both of us, module may show up at some point. I just didn't want people to be confused.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, last one is published, right? The definition to make information literature available for the public to view. In RPG terms, this means the product has been made. Often a PDF or, you know, dead tree book for commercial consumption. Not always commercial consumption, as in some people make these things and give them away. But I think we all know what we're getting at here. Published means that somebody else made the thing. You got it and are using it. You did not write it yourself.
There you go. All right. So to get started, let's talk about what published adventures give us that is different from writing our own. Jerry?
So why do we use published adventures? To begin with, published adventures are going to give us a number of positive things that make them useful to us as GMs. Good adventures, and we're going to stress the word good, can do a number of things. For example?
Yeah, so first of all, time saving in some respects. Mm-hmm. One of the most obvious reasons to use published adventures is that they actually are time savers. Someone else took the time to think of the scenario, write up the description, stat out the opposition, make the maps, all that stuff. And this can be useful if you are a GM with limited time, right? So like a job, career, family, running other games for people. I don't know, having a podcast or two, a publishing company, like whatever. Like maybe you don't have a lot of time, is a good time saver. And they provide encounters that like you can, you know, slot in between other parts of your own adventures if you chop them up.
Probably the most common thing I use them for.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that because we're going to talk about different ways to use these things.
Mm-hmm. The second thing they do is they give us ideas beyond our own or out of our comfort zone. Because the authors of these adventures are not you. And therefore, they may write about things that can be outside your comfort zone, some things you haven't thought about, or maybe some things you're just not as experienced with. They can also help by giving you the advantage to read and run these adventures that'll help you expand your knowledge as well as expand your comfort zones. And this is useful for GMs who want to learn a new genre or looking to expand their knowledge.
Yeah. Published adventures are great for teaching the core loop of a game. So adventures, especially the adventure that comes with the game. Mm-hmm. This is less true if you like go pick up a third party adventure that somebody else wrote, but the adventure that like comes with the game, usually what's called the introductory adventure, is a great example of how the designers envision the game is going to be played. Mm-hmm. Running that adventure will actually help teach you the core loop of the game. Like what are the activities, the situations that the characters are in? It'll even give you a structure that you can follow when you start to write your own, because you'll start to see like, oh, these things are important to put in my notes. I should do the same thing when I write mine. So they're useful for groups that are new to a type of game and kind of want to learn how the game works.
Another thing they give you is they give you the ability to be connected to other materials from that system or setting. An adventure that's put up by a publisher of a game is often connected to other material as part of that game line. In doing so, the elements of this adventure can be connected to other campaign material or others' adventures. This is going to create a continuity for the whole setting. And this often feels good, make it feel more like it's something bigger, make it feel like it's got more fanning involved. A good example of this for the old school people would be T1, the Village of Hamlet, that leads into the G, D, and Q series, or the Giants, Drow, and Queen of the Demon series, the old AD&D systems. And play them all together, and they form one long campaign that are all linked and kind of give you a feel for what that game world is supposed to be like. And this can be really useful for groups that really want to dig into the setting and experience it. And these days, a lot of companies are putting out better and better material that really ties into their game world in a way that lets you experience the game world without necessarily have to play everything in it and gives you a chance to move around it.
Yeah. Published adventures give you bonus rules and stuff. So published adventures often contain additional rules or monsters, powers, charts, magic items, spells. Like I remember as a kid, one of the coolest reasons to go pick up a module was to go flip immediately to the back and see like what new spells they added, what new monster was in there.
Magic.
Yeah, exactly.
Where's the loot?
What items? Yeah.
Did you guys ever get the Lost Cavern of Soldier Camp where they give you an entirely separate book of nothing but monsters, spells, and magic items?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so good.
So they're not only useful for the adventure they're in, but you totally can just pull them out of that book and use them in your own games going forward. Mm-hmm. And so in this respect, published adventures are really good for groups who want to get new goodies.
Lastly, they can be helpful for teaching you story structure. A good adventure is going to have a good story structure. And they can, by way of example, teach us how to run good adventures and how stories are written. Where to put in upbeats and downbeats, where to put in chases versus fights and the like. And this will go hand in hand with the idea about how to introduce new ideas. This can be useful for GMs who want to improve their skills at running new adventures, or GMs that just want to improve their skills at running good adventures.
Absolutely. So now that we have an understanding of what a published adventure can do for you, what are some of the things it can't do?
Right. They're not perfect. So for all the good things that Published Adventures do, they do have their limits. And there are things that they're not going to be able to do for you. Many of these tend to be the reasons why people don't use them. They're also the reason why you're going to need some sort of prep about these. And we'll get into that in a little bit as well. And I know as for reasons, like this was always my bullshit, right? Like this was every one of these will be the reasons I cited in the past for not using Published Adventures. I'm over it now, but I was very much adamant about this shit when I was more militant and younger. So here are some of the things that Published Adventures can't do.
First of all, they don't know your players. The writers of the adventure don't know your gaming group. They're going to write the adventure to a generic group of adventurers, and they're often deal with some default composition. For example, most D&D games are often written to have the fighter, wizard, cleric, and so they're not going to know how to run your game for a gunslinger, witch, druid, and acrobat. They also don't know the personalities of your players, their quirks, their motivations, and the like. And they don't know that your group might have plans on negotiating with the opposition versus fighting the opposition and won't have an encounter designed around that.
Right. They may just assume all your encounters are fights. Mm-hmm. All right. The other thing they don't know is they don't know your campaign. Right. The writers don't know where in your campaign this adventure falls unless you are running like one of those big full campaign arc adventures, right? That's like the whole book is the campaign, which there are some advantages to that, right? Like if you do that, then they actually do know where your campaign is because you're just following through the book. But normally if you just like pick up an adventure and are like, cool, I'm going to just drop this in my game, they don't know what's come before it. They don't know what arcs are out there, what enemies you've made. They don't know if you burned down a village and are hated over here. Those kinds of things. So they don't know what your characters have been up to. And so most adventures are kind of written self-encapsulated, right? With the hopes of just kind of being like an episode, right? Just dropped into the campaign. What it means is that it often doesn't have a really good on-ramp into the adventure or an off-ramp to like lead from the adventure to the next thing.
Exactly. Number three, they don't always know your GMing style. The writers don't know how you run your games. They're often the default to writing the adventure how the game expects you to run the game, or even worse, how they run the game. So that means there's a chance the style of adventure is not congruent with your GMing style, making running the adventure as written difficult without some prep.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever run into one of those adventures, but I've run into a few where I'm just like, oh, this is not how I do this. Like, I'm swimming upstream on this thing.
Yeah. Every adventure I run.
The other thing is they don't know how you prep your games / if you prep your games, but let's just assume you do some prep. Writers, they can't know how you like to prep your games. So in terms of like what you need to be included, as well as what visuals, like the way you want to display your information, how you want it laid out on the page for it to be useful for you, right? They are pretty much confined. Most adventures are pretty much confined to standard book format, right? 1 to 2 column text, you know, maybe some graphics inserted, some tables, but that's it. Like for me, I don't write anything in full text. My entire prep is nothing but nested bullet points, like headers and bullet points. That's it. Occasionally a table. And I have like a side column of additional stuff that I might need, you know, names, extra like copies of rules, pasted rules and things like that. That's not how adventures come, right? Totally don't come like that. And they can't come like that, right?
No.
It would probably be worse than the book format if they just made up a proprietary format, unless the game taught you that at the same time, which would be cool. And actually Trophy Gold, I will say, has a little bit of this. Trophy Gold has a format for how they present adventures, and the game kind of teaches you that format. So cool. It's an interesting concept. Anyway, Published Adventure is only going to be useful to you in as much as you can easily access the information while you're running the game, right? If the way that the information in the book is laid out is running counter to how you process and use information, the game is just going to be that much harder for you to run because you're going to be fighting where to find things and looking things up, et cetera.
Actually, they almost had an attempt at that way back in the day with Adventure B1 in Search of the Unknown, where they gave you the map and they gave you the plot and they just gave you a list of monsters and treasure and a bunch of blank spaces to fill it in and put notes down and some descriptions of the room.
Good point.
Yep.
But there were no real explanations on how to run it from there.
Yeah,
also problems.
It was a good learning tool.
Yeah. So no matter what kind of published adventure you have, it's pretty likely that you're going to need to do some kind of prep in order to get it ready to run at your table. Mm-hmm. Jerry, is it safe to assume that there's not one way, but rather a number of ways that a published adventure can be prepped?
Oh, come on. We all know there's only one way to have fun with any role-playing game. That's to do it one.
There is one true, the one true podcast. Yes. That's going to be our next podcast. Our next podcast is going to be our super preachy one true way podcast, where every topic we tell you exactly how to do it. And if you don't do it, you're having wrong, bad fun.
Yes.
That's coming soon.
That'll be our April Fool's issue.
Yes.
No, there are lots of ways that a published adventure can be prepped. And as long as you do it and have fun with it and your players have fun with it, there's no wrong way to do it. So, depending on why you're using the adventure, it's going to make a difference on what you want to do. So looking at the advantages mentioned above and what limitations you're struggling with and the previous list of shortcomings, you're going to want to prepare your published adventure for play in different ways at your table. So what we're going to talk about is a continuum of ways you can prep an adventure for play from the least intensive all the way up to the most intensive.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the first thing you can do, Phil?
So the least intensive is you could just read it. Right. It's the literally simplest thing you could do is just read the adventure. I say before you run it, but if you really wanted simple, you could probably read it while you're running it. Not advised, but at least read it before you take it to the table. Just give it a read through, have some understanding of like, oh, cool. There's a purple worm in here. And oh, there's some sort of, you know, cliff they're going to have to climb up, et cetera, et cetera. That's it. That's the bottom of the barrel. Read it.
Yep. Second thing is use a highlighter or some notes or some tabs. In addition to reading the adventure, you may want to highlight or add notes to the text to assist you in running the adventure. In a physical book, this could be using a highlighter and post-it notes. These days, the little small post-it tabs that they make can be good for just putting on the corner to keep track of where things are in the book. Maybe if they're going to go to the next chapter, or if there's a nice chart or an NPC slot or a map you want to show, just putting that in there will make the game go quickly and it will reduce your GM latency. In a PDF, you might be using an application that allows for highlighting or putting in call-out notes or something along that line.
That's what I do, actually, for DCC. But I think we'll talk about that when we get further down.
I have some questions I want to ask about how you use it. So
sure.
Next one, though, is you might want to highlight just important parts of the encounter. Or you might want to add notes to give you some additional information or reminders or places that you're going to put in things that tie directly to your characters. Which brings us to...
The next thing you do is you could write some supplemental material to go with your adventure, right? So you might feel the need to write a little additional material outside of what's been put into the published material. So this could be that on-ramp and off-ramp that we were talking about. So, you know, you've read the adventure and you're like, cool, I totally get what happens. I kind of need to get my players from where they are into this adventure. So let me write up like a scene or two that kind of gets them there, or let me write a scene or two of how I get them out of this back to their home base, that kind of thing. You might just have that like on the side of the, you know, of your highlighted adventure.
And then the next thing is you might start to do some rewrites and some customizing. You might need to take the adventure and rip parts of it in part or in whole in order to make the whole game fit better into your campaign. You might take the published material and make small changes just to integrate it in your world. You might change some of the opposition, the things that are part of your game, different monsters, different names, different locations. You might adapt misdirected mark. You might adapt a stat block to fit the encounter you want to have. Maybe if it's too tough or not, or not difficult enough. And especially if you're trying to convert from one game system to another.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
I do that all the time.
Right.
And you may be rewriting the entire adventure to better display the information to make running the game easier.
Yeah. I mean, if there's a better way for you to process it, you might be, you know, converting the game over that. All right. So finally, the last thing you can do, and I know this is another specialty of yours, Jerry, you can just decompose the entire adventure, right? Like you can just totally rip the whole thing apart. and just take the parts you like out of it and use them somewhere else, or use a couple of them and then throw the rest away, whatever. Mm-hmm. Save the other pieces for another adventure, whatever. You can just totally like just dissolve this thing in acid and just take the chunks out of it, right?
Yep.
At this level, the adventure isn't even really the adventure anymore, right? It's just source material for other things that you're going to create with it. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, at this far down the chain, it's a little hard to tell whether you are prepping published material or really just kind of writing your own material from it, right? Like we've lost which part you're in. You drift over the line at this point.
We're going to give some examples of that when we get in the second half of the show.
Yeah. Yep.
So, okay. Yeah. So now that we've covered what published adventures can and can't do, as well as some techniques, starting out, some techniques for prepping them.
We're in scramble.
We're going to take a break. We're going to check in with the chat room. But before that, I'm going to tell you about the Gnomecast, which I highly recommend you check out when you can. Several gnomes from Gnome Stew get together to talk about gaming topics and themselves in an effort to entertain you and avoid being thrown in the stew. They will, on many occasions, get guests to come on with them that are not gnomes. It's entertaining. It's fun. I did a Gnome Stew episode once a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. But check it out when you get the chance. Now, the chat room. We're arguing about pineapple and pizza not being able to go together.
Why?
I mean, the focus of these people is their ability to, you know, to look into the topic and understand that they can just talk about pizza.
I mean, they might as well just be talking about peanut butter and jelly going together.
To be honest, they're not talking about putting pineapple on pizza. They're talking about putting pizza on pineapple, if you read it correctly.
No. They started out kind of asking thing. About pineapple on pizza, and I said, but what about pizza on a pineapple?
Ah.
And then everything just went off the rails. So.
And to be honest, what's the bigger discussion we're having on there? What's the flavorful discussion? Peach cobbler.
Oh, yeah, the peach cobbler. But
here's my problem, right? That my fundamental problem with pineapple on pizza is red sauce, right? I feel like if you could just make a different sauce that complemented both the pineapple and the ham, because if you're going to put pineapple on your pizza, you might as well put ham on your pizza. Sorry, Senda, but we're going to have to put a little hog on here to make it go.
My favorite pizza is cheese and ham.
Sure.
I get ham on pizza all the time. And
a little pineapple.
But I don't get pineapple because pineapple is bad.
But I'm just saying red sauce and pineapple, that's a tough mix. But if you had a better sauce.
See, I disagree. I don't like pineapple, but pineapple, the sweetness with the tanginess of a standard red sauce is a good complement. Whereas if you put it on something with like an Alfredo or some kind of white sauce, that's not going to work.
I'm not saying it's either one of those, but I'm saying there's another sauce, maybe a barbecue. That would go with that.
I mean, a barbecue would probably like a barbecue chicken pizza with some pineapple on it. Probably be good. I
dump the chicken, go barbecue, ham, pineapple. Like, there's ways to make this work.
There are ways to make it.
Anyway, no chatty about prepping adventures. We should just do a pizza podcast tonight.
We should do a pizza podcast one of these.
Yeah, nothing going on in there, guys. Tap tap tap. Are the inmates quiet tonight?
I'm sure when we get into the round table, they'll be far more in-depth.
they're discussing food, and Schmitty said that he doesn't want any weird pizza, just deep dish. So I don't know what to say about that.
I got nothing. Let's just...
No wrong bad pizza. Let's go.
There you go. Okay, so after that gripping diversion, it's back to our round table segment. What's our first question, Phil?
First question is, how much do you use published adventures in your own games?
For me, it really depends on the game and the system, but I often steal bits and pieces for adventures in my games. I use a map for a small town or some encounters. I love the trial rules from Pathfinder's Trial of the Beast, for a courtroom drama. And actually, that adventure by itself is a decent adventure for the first half to run about any game system. I like the heist rules from Savage Lankmar and use them in almost every game. Dungeon in the Box every month has themed charts and encounters that fit a particular thing like woodland encounters or traveling on the road or inside a town or during a festival. And I'll use a lot of that stuff, even if I don't use the adventure itself, or only if I, even if I only use one little section of that adventure because it's a good set piece. But right now I'm running the original Eberron modules, heavily adapted as a mini campaign. I'm using a very loose plot line and a few of the encounters, but I've removed some of the stuff, removed some of the combats and some of the longer like dungeon crawling. I've added a lot of role-playing encounters, changed a lot of its patrons and some of the big movers that they fit through the motivations of the characters, because, you know, the players are the most important part of the game. And I'll change who's in charge or who the bad guy is if it fits something better that they've already done. So I do a lot of little things with published adventures. And to be honest, I found a lot of the smaller modules and smaller adventures to fit really well into lots of different game systems. If you just change the stat block, and sometimes shorten some of the encounters up a little bit. But I have a whole slew of them that I'll use, and oftentimes just drag them out for Barbarians of Lemuria, Savage Worlds, Dungeons and Dragons, Ironclaw, whatever game system we happen to be using that week. So how about you, Phil?
Yeah, you know, so I used to be a real pain in the ass about this. so much so that eons ago, I wrote an article on Gnome Stew about why I hated published adventures. I have since gone back and wrote a counter argument to my own argument about why I love published adventures. But for the longest time, I did not use published material. I would read source books and get ideas, and I might use splat books to put out, like pull NPCs or whatever. But like I was all on my bullshit about like I'm making my own stuff, couture, right? Like I'm going to hand make all this shit myself. And I liked that for a long time. Like I, you know, would highly customize all that stuff, which was fine. Like there's nothing wrong with it. It's perfectly acceptable. I ran many years like that. But over the years, I decided to just kind of give published material a chance instead of being like completely a dick about it. Mm-hmm. actually, I now use published material a lot. Of the games I'm running right now, Numenera, I don't know if I'm going to use published adventures for that or not, if I'm just going to write my own shit. I suspect I'm going to write my own shit for it, but I can't be 100% sure. In Forbidden Lands, I've been using all the stuff that was in the core book, and we're about to use the campaign book, The Raven's Purge. And that stuff's like a little loose, like that's not a, that's like a whole bunch of locations, adventure sites that you just drop in the game. And then you got to kind of string them together yourself. And then lastly for DCC, and I think we'll talk about this, right? Because our next question's about prepping them. So DCC, I use only published adventures. I'm not doing any writing for DCC whatsoever. I'm just running, I'm literally running modules. So yeah, my pendulum on this has gone completely the other way from I used to write it all myself to shit, let me see what you got. Like I will give it a shot. Like I'll take a look at the published stuff, and if I like it, I will run it. And if I don't like it, I'll roll up my sleeves and write that shit myself.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Babo.
So I've done both back in the day when I used to GM. Most of the games that I ran were stuff that I wrote myself. And it was all shit.
It wasn't all shit.
It was loads of shit with an occasional shit covered, you know, gemstone in it, maybe a coin here and there. The best game I ever ran was my 4E game, where I used all of the published material, and we hit a ball with that. That, however, I'm not going to take all the credit or give all the credit to the published adventures. That was a confluence of using the published stuff, having a great table, and everything kind of coming together. But that all being said, going forward, if I ever GM again, I will most likely take something that is published and use that as my starting point and then tweak as necessary. Because I don't feel the need personally to go from scratch unless there's like nothing out there that suits me. For whatever game that I'm going to run down the road, I'm sure there's going to be something that I can be like, all right, I'll use this as the foundation, and I'll just kind of branch off. So
yeah, that's fair.
You know what? I thought of something else that, published adventures don't do. And this goes back, they don't stoke the elitist 80s era, I'm better than that, I don't need published adventures feeling that people want to get. You can't feel holier than thou if you're running a published adventure.
Yeah,
I mean, feel holier than thou? I told you that I wrote my own shit for a long time.
Oh, that
because
would be
so- I was better than all of you.
He spoke
right?
his best.
I was. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. What's question number two, Terry?
Question number two: do we have one approach to prepping published adventures, or does it vary? So, Phil. What kind of approaches do you have for prepping published adventures?
Yeah, actually, like if we use the descriptions of the stuff above, I actually do take different approaches for different adventures. Like, so for instance, for DCC, I just highlight it. That's it. I read and highlight. And I actually use Goodreader on my iPad, which is an app that will allow you to open PDFs and actually highlight them. So I have like a little color coding scheme for them. So I have like text I need to read to you in one color, mm-hmm. which is typically blue. I have important rules or information in the encounter highlighted in yellow. So like, you know, if like in the middle of the room, it's like there's a hidden trap that's going to go off when the players step on the rug. Like I highlight that so that I don't forget to do that when we're in the room. And then stat blocks I do in green so that like in the middle of the game, when you guys are ready to fight, my eye immediately goes to where the stat block is so I can kind of zoom in on it as we're playing. So that one's like my minimal prep, right? Read it, highlight it as I'm reading it. When I did Tales from the Loop, I really liked the mysteries that were in the published in the actual game themselves, right? There's an arc of mysteries. But I customized the shit out of them. I customized them so much that I essentially rewrote the mysteries in OneNote into my bulleted format so that I could do all the adjustments for the characters and take the adventure and blend it with the meta arc that I made up on my own. Mm-hmm. So the mysteries that we played were pretty much the same mystery. But they felt completely like they were our mysteries because I had dismantled it and wove in all of our stuff to it. And then, of course, bracketed it on both ends with the personal character stories, which were huge in our those were a massive component of our game. And then like for Forbidden Lands, it's a little bit of both. I read the adventure site. I will jot a few notes about the adventure site, but like when I run for the game, I have like OneNote open and I have the actual physical book with the adventure site. And I'm kind of like reading from my notes, looking at things in the book. It's, I don't know, it's a little messy on that one, mm-hmm. but it seems to work. Okay. So the answer is I use different approaches because I use the approach to achieve what I need in order to bring the game to the table. The way I want to bring it to the table. How about you, Bob?
Yeah, it's the same thing for me going forward. If I go throw something down on the table, it's going to be depending on what game system I'm running, whether or not there are published adventures for it. And if there are published adventures, is there something that, you know, that stands out to me that I want to do? Is it, you know, is it campaign, you know, with players where we're going to have, you know, characters that we're, you know, really invested in, or is it going to be one shot where it's like, just drive it like you stole it. So, you know, throw them through anything and it's not going to matter as much. Like there's tons of factors. So it's going to be a roller coaster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's okay.
Someday though, I keep saying this, someday I'm going to put myself in the GM chair again.
I feel like it would make an awesome set of episodes would be to in a very much Mickey and Apollo Creed kind of way, like we start training you to like go back behind the screen and like, you know, we do it like through the show, like we start prepping you for going behind the screen, and then we'll have you run something, not on the air because you don't need added pressure, but have you run something and then we'll do like a whole like post-game analysis.
Yeah.
having never seen any of the Rocky movies, I know who Apollo Creed is. I don't know who Mickey is. And so my visual image there initially was probably different than yours.
Yeah.
Hey, Apollo, get your arms up. Anyway, go ahead.
I can just see Bob, like he's weaving under, he's weaving under a, under a rope. And we like send him out back to catch a chicken with his bare hands.
The PCs throw me a big curve. I don't know what to do. I'm all flabbergasted. Cut me, Mick.
don't catch a cockatoo with your bare hands. Like I said, it's going to depend a lot on what I'm using it for. I always try to read it first and then decide what I want to keep. If it's a well-written adventure, a really well-written adventure, I may just change some names and some stat blocks. That's going to be about it. But oftentimes I'm going to trim a little bit here and there, make some story notes on where I think the plot should go or where I think the plot's going to go based on my players. List some character connections, reasons why they're going to be there, make a note of places and names, prep a game document of some sort with just some hints, because I know that, especially with the two different player groups I have now, they can be overly logical about stuff, and even if the bait's in front of them, they'll take the hook, but they're going to be looking for a better reason than often what they give you in the game for the hook. You know, they're not going to do it just because they want wealth or to rescue the princess. They're going to want a personal connection. And then lastly, because almost everything I run is for a different game system than what it's written for, I'm going to have to slap together a couple of quick stat blocks. So, but I just try to keep, oftentimes I will keep it in a separate Google Docs document so I can edit it as I go, so that when I'm running the game, I can add and make changes on the fly. So I'm going to prep the game with the idea that it might change a little bit on the fly as it goes. But pretty much that's about it. It doesn't often take that long to do one. So. Cool.
All right. Yeah, I mean, I think depending on the game system that you are converting into, what you have to kind of stat up will be more or less chunky. If you're converting it to run in Champions, that's going to be a lot more work than converting it to run in Savage Worlds, where you're just like D8, D10, D6.
Yeah.
Gun, good check, let's go.
Yeah.
Even when I convert other games back, when I was converting games to play D&D, I would just go armor class, hit points, base to hit damage, and then here are their basic numbers, and I'm just going to make some quick notes on what I want the monsters and bad guys to do. I don't care if it follows a format, because I'm just running this adventure to get the what the players want. I think that's something else that's kind of a reason that when you look at converting a game system over or prepping a document, especially if it's a quote unquote classic game, is why are you running it and what are you trying to get out of it? If you're trying to run Village of Hamlet, you're looking to get a couple of key things out of that. You want them to have the connection to the Temple of Elemental Evil. You want them to have a couple of encounters in town so they can see the just barely underboiling conflict between the two religions. And then you want to have them go to the moat house and have the classic, the three kind of iconic encounters in the moat house, regardless of everything else. And make sure you have those all prepped and set up so that no matter what they do, they have a chance to encounter those. Because that's the things that everybody remembers from playing that adventure. And if you want to have new players get the same feeling that we had back then, those are the things I'm going to be focused on. If they don't get a chance to encounter the spider and the snake, that's okay, as long as they encounter the giant toads and the big battle in the courtyard. And that's what I want to be looking for, is how to make sure that they have those kind of iconic situations. And it's going to be different for everybody else. You ask people, what do they remember about Descent into the Depths of the Earth? And I don't think there are any iconic encounters in the first half of that adventure. It's just a bunch of tunnels.
I barely remember it.
Yeah, I actually don't remember anything iconic about. What I remember isn't iconic about the adventure. What I remember is what the iconic thing we did in one of those encounters. Mm-hmm. I agree. I think that sometimes you can, especially in different systems, because different systems consume material at different rates. Yeah. So you can actually drop a whole bunch of stuff from an adventure for a different game system and boil it down to the same essence.
And that's the kind of thing you want to, that's the kind of thing you want to make your notes on. Is one of the things you want to make sure the players have a chance to encounter if they want to out of this adventure. And that makes a difference.
Cool.
Real quick, I ran Palace of Silver Princess for my 5e group and modified it heavily because both editions of it are kind of weird. But I wanted to make sure that they got the battle with the Decapus, the final encounter with the gemstone and the white dragon, and the dangers of the red mist outside. Everything else was wherever they ended up going in the place. You know, there were other encounters to have. But as long as I had those three key notes, I made sure that I could at least get them in that direction. If they started going off adventure, I could kind of steer them back, give them better bait to get them to hook back in. So we could all do that.
Okay, cool.
All right.
Okay, so question three. Mm-hmm. In terms of helping you prep your published adventures, what could designers do to help?
Yeah, so I think that, I'm the one who threw this question onto the list with the idea that a lot of times people just write adventures and you're kind of on your own for prepping it, right? Like there's like an assumption, like it ain't my job to help you, you know, like it ain't my job to help you with this. So things that I would like, I personally, so these are all just going to be me things, right? Mm-hmm. I could do a lot less with paragraphs and a lot more with bullets.
Yes.
I don't think you need to be as, now I say that, but I also understand how freelancers get paid. Yeah. And so this runs against a high word count, but often what I need in an adventure is kind of how I write my own adventures. Mm-hmm. What's going on here? Right. Mm-hmm. Like, give me the lowdown, what's going on so that I know. And then for the actual encounters, like I just need some bullets. Like, and I need it in bullets because that's how, when I'm playing the adventure, especially if I'm running something prep, that's how I'm going to scan this information. If I got to read like three long paragraphs in a two column thing to remember that, you know, there's a force field around the third statue, like maybe I'm going to remember when I see it highlighted. Maybe I'm not, but if it was like statues, boom, 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 force field, like, you know what I mean? Like, there's a thing about visual consumption, right? And I, like, again, adventures tend to write them like books, but we don't run like that.
No,
so I would like that. The other thing I would really like, because I could go on and on, but I'll just say the other thing. The other thing I would really like is a plot map.
Yes.
Like, just take a page and show me, like, here are the encounters, like here are the encounters line up, so that I can kind of quickly look and be like, okay, I'm running short on time. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you know, I just don't even want to touch this branch of the adventure, and it doesn't seem to do anything. And I've encountered mm-hmm. that one time in a DCC adventure that I ran from Purple Sorcerer's Games, Neblin's something or other. I'll find the name when somebody else takes over. But it had a thing where it had a set of encounters, and then there was a note that was like, look, if you're running short on time, collapse this hallway.
Yeah.
So that the players don't go down this hallway. It's not that important. Mm-hmm. Like, if your players are running ahead of schedule, leave this hallway in. It'll give them some more things to do, but otherwise, drop it. It doesn't matter. And I was like, hey, thank you. Like, that's like useful advice for me, like clock management. And more importantly, telling me like these encounters are kind of fluff.
Yep.
Would that have been Nebin Pendlebrook's Perilous Pantry?
Thank you. Which is, by the way, a fantastic DCC adventure. I ran it at GatorCon. And it's a zero level adventure. We had a blast playing it.
And it's got a great name.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, man.
All right. That's me, Jer.
All right. For me, I kind of go with Phil. Start with an outline of the adventure or the supplement. What's going to happen in this adventure? And this kind of stuck to me hard. I was reading through a couple of the old V&V modules, those Vigilantes, to convert them over to Face Rip. And I looked at one of them, and it's three small adventures. And I realized that the adventure is only like 5 pages long, but you have to read the entire adventure to know what the plot of the adventure is. And just start out with, hey, in this adventure, the players are going to be going up against, you know, a rising big bad action man and his plot to, you know, steal all the Freytag's pyramids from the museum. and this is how it's going to go. You know, that would be just a nice little summary of the adventure so that I know what I'm going to be doing and where I need to get the players to go. Number two, break it into smaller encounters. I don't need lots of combat in my games. Every game I run, I like combats, but I don't like games where the entire thing is just a dungeon crawl. And so I want better paced combat encounters, more role-playing encounters, basically better beat structure. And that's what I like in a game. So show me the plot so I know if I want to add an extra role-playing encounter and I can do that. Or if I see, wow, there's a bunch of dungeon stuff here, but this is all that matters, I can take out the stuff that's going to slow down our game. I know that because one of the games one of the groups I run for, I ran the Lost City, the D&D adventure where you go through the pyramid for 100 rooms. And they walked past everything that wasn't an obvious role-playing encounter. My player is like, oh, there's monsters in there. We're just going to walk past that one. And avoided most of the adventure. And I know that, but I could have planned that adventure better and needed to kind of plot it out. So looking at that is something important. I like better editing. The number of times that I read an adventure and stuff is all over the place. There's no real formula. There's no glossary at the back for all the new terms you put in. Spells are just stuck in willy-nilly as opposed to being collected all in one spot. So you can go to one place to reference them. All that makes it tougher to run that adventure for me. It means there's more prep time I need to do ahead of time. And lastly, I love charts of random stuff. If the players are going to be going to, you know, the thieves' quarter, give me a chart with 5 or 6 interesting encounters there. So if the players decide to wander on a little bit, I have something in front of me right off the bat. If they're going to go, had us mention earlier the Giant series. One of my favorite things in there was the chart of random stuff found in the Giant's packs. You know, the players decided to loot a Giant. It's not all the same thing. What's in there? That kind of stuff makes it fun for me because I can build an entire encounter off of that if the players want to do something besides just go on to the next combat. So that's the kind of stuff I want. Give me an outline. Give me some more small encounters. Give me more charts. And give me better beat structure. Bob?
Cool. So I thought about this a lot, and at first I couldn't really think of anything, and I'm like, you two are going to really, you're going to hit the high points anyway. But something occurred to me during the course of the show a little bit earlier, and it reminded me of something that Phil is very fond of doing. Give me shorthand for creating the opposition. So, like, if you've got, like, your typical module, it's like, you've got these bad guys. Boom, 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 boom. If anybody strays from the path, or if you need to make up something on the fly, having some kind of shorthand, and this is more for a game rather than the module itself, more for you know, like, here's this new game system. Give us some kind of shorthand for making opposition. As Phil likes to do, he creates a framework. Mm-hmm. And then he just paints stuff over the top of that framework and says, okay, here's a typical soldier. Here's a typical merchant. Here's a whatever. The smartest thing any game designer ever did was deciding that the opposition doesn't have to follow the same creation rules as the players. If you don't have to sit there and go, oh God, these guys are going up against a 20th level wizard tonight. Fuck me. I got to create a 20th level wizard. No, you don't. Just give them the shit you want them to use. Give them some basic stats and fly. Putting all that effort into somebody that they're going to pound the shit out of and has the potential, depending on the game system, of being dead quick.
I actually love, I was just reading Numenera Discovery last night, and I'm in the deep into the GMing section of it, and there's a whole paragraph about, you do not prep the opposition the same way the characters are made. Like,
that was
Monty lays it all out. He's like, that is not how this works. He's like, you want them to have a thing, they got a thing.
Yep.
You just, like, you need to give them a difficulty. You need to give them a certain amount of health. You need to decide if a few things are better than their base difficulty, what kind of powers you want to see. Write it all down. You're done. Yeah.
So
very empowering.
Yeah. Super smart idea. The ideal thing would be what you want in a published adventure is flexibility. All right. In theory, the way I'm thinking of it is the more flexible it is to be able to run for my group and Jerry's group and Susie's group and Tom's group and whoever, you know, the broader the appeal of it is that you don't have to, like, oh, my group doesn't do a lot of combat. Mm-hmm. My group likes to do heavy role play, and this seems like it's leaning more towards the combat. Like, mm-hmm. if you can give me an adventure that gives me more flexibility,
yep.
then you're more likely to sell that adventure to me. And there's a lot of people like that. And it occurs to me now during this whole conversation that we were talking about, you know, people get paid by word count. And you run into these issues where it's like, oh, you know, we only have 96 pages for this or whatever. That's typically splat book size. So I'm like, pick whatever page count your typical adventure is. I don't know, 20 something.
32.
It's been a while. 32?
Multiples of 16, 32. Yep.
Yeah. So here you've got 32 pages. So your word count for this adventure has got to come into 32 pages. And then the person writing the adventure is like, oh, shit. Like, I had this whole thing over here that I got to cut because I don't have room for it. I had to trim this off because I didn't have room for it. But there's tons of prose, always. There's tons of backstory. There's tons of, if you can go through your adventure and in the places where it makes sense, go to bullet points like Phil said. And instead of having big paragraphs of shit, go to bullet points. If you've got bullet points, you save some word count there. You might be able to add more word count for flexibility somewhere else.
Or detail, yeah.
Or detail for something else, whatever. And, you know, if you could do that, if you could come up with the adventure that is flexible and still gives you enough detail to work with what you want, can be tailored to switch back and forth between combat focus groups or role-playing focus group, where you could say, you know, you could take this particular encounter, you could chat with these guys instead of fighting them. If you can blend that stuff, you got gold on your hands.
I can't remember the name of the third-party company, but it was a company that put out modules back for, like, first, second edition D&D and other game systems back. Might have been White Dwarf Magazine and some other things. But one of the companies, whenever they had a stat block, it was always things like armor, heavy, combat ability, low, medium, or high, you know, health, low, medium, or high. And they never gave you stats. The idea was whatever the situation was going to be, first of all, it's supposed to be generic system. But also the idea was that you put it together based on how challenging you need it for that encounter.
Yep.
And because in D&D, high health is very different than D&D in, or like the high health in like RuneQuest or Savage Worlds or GURPS, you know, made it easy to convert. That's a really good point, Bob.
Yeah. And like, if you look at one thing that we have done with a couple of things that we did for, in Encoded Designs that we did for some of the stuff that we've published, is here's how you can tailor this. There's like a section like how to tailor this for certain situations.
Mm-hmm.
You're making me think I wrote a you make me think I wrote a section of Dangerous Space Jail that's like, here's how to hack this adventure.
Yes, exactly. So yeah. if you can save word count in one place to leave room for things like that. Maybe you've got, I saved some by taking some of these huge paragraphs and boiling them down to bullet points that are still as useful, actually positively, maybe even more clear. You might have room for that random table that would be useful for that one room, which would make Jerry happy. Or you may have room for the how to hack this thing or how to adjust it for a higher level party or, you know. So the more flexibility you can build into an adventure, the better off you're going to be as far as broader appeal. And there's a sweet spot in there somewhere. And if somebody can find it, they might make some money.
Yeah,
I agree. That's good.
All right. So that is our segment on prepping published adventures.
Yeah. We hope that the next time you pick up a published adventure and get ready to run it, that some of this advice will remind you of the different ways that you can use a published adventure and some of the different things you might need to do to it.
Mm-hmm. And now it's time to check in with the chat room for life and then on to the conversation corner. And in the chat room, I think Evil John made the comment, because you talked earlier about why is it so difficult? Why don't people writing make it easy for you to prep the adventure? And John's comment was, Why prep? If an adventure was hard to write, it should be hard to run.
That's the Klingon DM philosophy right there. Ugh.
Is that it?
Yeah.
I mean, I will say this. If I pick up an adventure and start reading it and I'm like, huh? Like, what's going on? The chance I'm running this adventure is nil.
Yeah.
Like, if I pick up an adventure and I read it and it's like, cool, Phil, here's what's going down, right? Like, here's what's going on in the game. Mm-hmm. And let you know, like the DCC ones actually do a really good job. Like, you don't, you guys never see it, but before you get into the module part of the DCC thing, there's always an introduction that like tells you like what weird shit is going on.
Yeah.
So that like, so that as you're reading it, you're like, uh-huh, I get it. Because I mean, truthfully, most DCC modules are pretty fucking weird.
Yes.
Just a little bit.
That is a
and
feature,
so,
yeah.
it's a great feature because I really, it's the reason I don't actually write my own, other than also I don't want to make dungeon crawls, right? Like, I don't want to make actually like 10 encounter dungeon crawls because I'm lazy and I don't want to make maps. But one of those things I really like about DCC is that they do a really good job of making it like Gygaxian weird. Like, this shit is just really strange as you get like deeper into each one of these modules. Like, the one we're playing now is just straight up bonkers. Yeah. Like, there wasn't, they like, normally it's like, oh, it's a little weird, we get down another level or two and it gets weirder, but like, this one started it weird and I think it just gets weirder. So DCC does a decent job of kind of prepping me ahead of time. The other one that was really good about that was Tales from the Loop. The mystery always tells you like, here's what's actually going on. Mm-hmm. And I think for mysteries, it's really crucial that the GM has a full understanding of what's going on, because they're the ones who have to not only disseminate clues, but may have to improv clues. And if you don't really have a good grasp of what the mystery is and why it's mysterious, you might just like barf up the wrong clue in a pinch. And then, you know, short circuit your adventure. Like, you know, you barf up a clue in improv and everybody's like, oh, it's this. And you're like, damn it. Right. Like, so, yeah. But I will say this. If somebody takes a really sophisticated game and makes it easy to like a sophisticated plot and makes it easy to run, that shit is gold.
Yep.
Yep.
We had a good comment from Chromatic Chameleon. They have trouble molding adventures to their PCs. And that's discouraging to them. You know, if you have to mod the published adventure to do that, then what's the point? And depending on what kind of PCs you've got, what your table makeup is, that can be difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If it's,
and depending, I think, on the style of game that you want to run.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Some people get off easy. Some people only need to make a few tweaks and it's like, all right, I can get this thing to wrap around my players and my characters.
Yeah. Like, but, for instance, if you're playing Star Trek Adventures, you probably aren't going to have too much effort to adapt one of the published adventures to fit your group, because the game is like, the setting and situation of the game kind of lends itself to that. But if I'm playing like a Game of Thrones style game and then I'm chucking in like an AD&D second edition module, that's like a, you know, that's a road, like that's a bump, right? Like, to try to get that to gel in. Like, I do think some games and the way you choose to play them suit dropping in published stuff better than others.
Yeah.
Like, I never used published material for our vampire game. I handcrafted all that shit because our vampire game didn't look like anything else. Like, it was strictly our city, our vampires.
We didn't roll dice.
We didn't even use the rules. Like, we just made up our own house rules. Like, but it's true. Like, the same thing with Con X. I never used for Conspiracy X. I never used a published adventure for Conspiracy X. Those were handcrafted, and I was totally content leaving it at that. And yeah, it is tough because, like we said in earlier, right, if adventure writers can't know your yeah. your adventurers. And if you want, and if you're doing something really deep like that, you really do want to have like really good ties. And then you get into that that really labor intensive range of, well, like I did with Tales from the Loop. I dismantled those adventures and rewrote them because I needed them to be about your aunt, yeah. not the Lena character that was in the stories. And we had added on like more stuff about her. I had to like blend all that shit together.
Yeah, by sitting down during our session zero and creating depth to the world and depth to the characters and all the connections and different stuff like that to make it feel like it was A, lived in, and B, ours. You diverge from the default, you know, vanilla version of all the stuff that's in the book. Uh-huh. So being able to tweak that.
Right. And the balance point was I did a lot of work rewriting it, but what it saved me was we were playing a mystery game, and mystery games tend to be very labor intensive because you have to kind of not only come up with the mystery, but you have to come up with how you're going to parse out the clues, how you're going to pace the clues and all of that. So I was able to take that piece from the published adventure and then mix it with our personal shit to come up with something that blended, like something that it was still a lot of time, but I think that it was less time than if I had to make up my own mysteries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think for a ton of people out there, the holy grail of adventure module scenario from a publisher is one that is flexible and gives you guidelines to adjust on the fly to your group and your characters and your world, and makes it easier for you to do all the things that you need to do while still giving you an interesting story for your characters to play through.
So a cool way to set that up would be to kind of do to the GM as the designer of the adventure, what a GM would do to their players, right? So if I wrote my adventure as, here's a situation that's going down, here's some things that are going to happen, but I don't write any solutions to them, right? I make them open for however you want to solve them. I make a little web of, you know, this encounter leads to this encounter. And then I front load a bunch of pointed questions at the GM so that I could be like, and this would be cool where, indulge me for a second. Remember when we were kids, they would have those cheesy things where it would be like, you could buy a book and it's all about you, right? And like you would buy this book and they would just like insert the name Phil like into the story.
Yes.
Right. And then you'd read it and be like, ooh, this book's about me because, you know, somehow like it seems special because, you know, it got made about you.
Was in it, yeah.
Right. But you could, for instance, make like a PDF with placeholders, mm-hmm. right? And ask the question like, in this adventure, who is the opposition that your players are going to face, right? And you would just pull from your campaign, type it in, and it would just replace it, mm-hmm. right, in the PDF. And what, you know, like, what goal are they trying? Like, if you Mad Libbed this thing, you could make a published adventure out of it.
We started doing something similar to that in one of the things we were working on. And I don't remember if it was something that ever saw the light of day or if it's still sitting in a folder somewhere. But it was like, you know, this, you know, guild name.
Yes. You know,
and we put placeholder names in there in bold in the text.
Yep. Go find your stuff. Like this organization, right? And then you just take from your campaign, like, what's an organization that's allied with your, you know, with your players? The Scrappers Guild. Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
Put that in. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you can get the flexibility in a published adventure like that.
Mm-hmm. Mad Lib adventure. Mad libbed.
I mean, it seems like such a simple concept. Like, why hasn't anybody figured this out yet? And yet, you know, like Wizards of the Coast, their D&D adventures, they keep churning out essentially the same style of thing over and over and over again. And it's like,
But that's not their goal. As much as I personally don't enjoy the Adventure League adventures, they're written for a very particular reason. And They're written a very particular way and aren't really designed to be modified. They don't want you to modify them at all because they're trying to get everybody to play the exact same thing. So that if you go from Buffalo to Chicago and you play in Schmitty's Adventurers League group, you've had the same experience as somebody else did. Yeah, they don't.
Yeah, if it's Adventurers League designed, then yeah, you have to have a consistent game experience. Mm-hmm. But if it's not designed specifically for the Adventurers League, I think you can take some liberties with your design and say, look, we're going to make this thing and anybody can play this depending on, you know, regardless of what kind of group you have and da 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 da.
I'm kicking myself because there is a set of modules out there like that. And I can't remember which games. It's from about 10 years ago. So I don't remember which game system it was for. But there was one that did that sort of thing where they had a lot of slip in your player's, you know, main contact or this person.
Yeah.
If they don't have, I can't remember what. It was somebody's.
I mean, and nowadays you could really one up that and just have like go to a website, fill in all that shit, hit a button, have it populate the PDF, download the PDF, your adventure's ready to run.
Yep.
Yeah.
Customized and tricked out for you.
That would be cool. Everybody get on that.
Yeah.
So we have another opportunity here tonight. We have a new person in the chat room.
Welcome. The
handle is Select Striker 2.
Hello, like Select Striker 2.
How you doing? Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show.
And they said they like it when they identify the important points or pieces of information. And that is huge. They go on to say they always seem to change some piece of info that seems unimportant and then find out later that the item interacted somewhere else in the adventure and it either breaks something or they have to retcon something. And it's like,
Hey, Ken.
Cool. Ken from Prison. Yeah. His misdirected Mark word scramble. Prismatic Tsunami.
Oh, yes. As I said at the top of the show, I played with Ken over the weekend.
But yeah, if you don't highlight this kind of information in your adventure when you're publishing it, you're not doing the GM any favors. If there's something that's important 6 pages in, and you mentioned it on page one, you know, highlight the fact like, hey, this is going to be important. Don't lose sight of this thing, you know. So those are the kind of things that. That would be super helpful in game.
And that's the kind of thing, like, you don't even have to get super technical on. Yeah. That's the kind of thing where in the description, you could be like, this key, see encounter 7 on page 25, you know, like
a lot of simple ways that you can call that out.
And the reverse is also true. The adventure I'm running right now starts out with this long description of a vampire lord in the city that never shows up.
Oh.
Why focus all that word count on somebody that's completely unimportant?
It's because they influence somebody else, but after that, they don't show up again. They don't show up. I mean, you can shortcut that. Yeah, you don't actually know their reasoning. You don't know what they've been doing. You don't know how they were encountered. Any of that. Yeah. It's just character A encountered character B, and that's where the adventure starts. Which is part of what I rewrote. but when you see that, you're like, that doesn't come up, you know, you're looking through the book for, okay, where does this come back up again? And it's not there.
So yeah. I did that in my first draft of Dangerous Space Jail. Like I wrote all this shit, like this background stuff. And Merwin came back and was like, lop this thing right out. He's like, none of this is useful other than it tells a whole story before the GM starts. And they don't really need to know that much of the story.
Yeah, nope.
These two creatures are lovers and they're trying to escape the jail together and go.
Yep.
Like I had this whole thing, like they led this like rebellion against the like forces of law, blah, blah, blah. And Merwin's like, hack that shit. You like, it's not needed for the GM to accurately run this adventure. And I was like,
good editor.
Yep. Yep. Or if you think that stuff might be important to the story, like the players might ask those questions, put it in a bullet point at the end. If your players ask about ABC, here are some points you can give them off the
fluff. You've got some word count left over and you want to give them a little extra fluff like that.
Yeah, because sometimes players will ask things like that. Like, I want to read the book on the table. What's it say? Well, you get this information. Bing, bing, bing. You're done. You know?
Yeah.
None of it's important, but here you go.
There you go.
All right.
Because players will do that.
Good talk. Thanks again for the topic.
Thanks for the input.
And I think it's time for us to bump into the conversation corner.
That's right.
All right, let me do the thing here. Bam, 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 bam. I love that.
I just read your notes. Go ahead. Go first.
What's that?
So oh, you just read my...
Okay.
Go first.
Yeah, so our Forbidden Lands characters are shitty campers.
Oh, my God.
We are... we love this game, and when we get into a combat, we usually rock pretty hard. My dwarf is a beast, and he's got a weapon that's a beast. I roll a shit ton of dice when I'm fighting. I roll less dice when I'm trying to help us make camp. And here's the thing. If you fail at making camp, that is finding a good location and setting up, then you can't sleep at night. And if you can't sleep at night, you can't heal up the damage that you've accrued. And you do that two nights in a row and you get sleepy and everything gets all fucked up. And so we were traveling through known hexes that we had been through before. And we just needed to, you know, set up camp and sleep for the night. And we did, what, 3 days in a row we fucked up camp?
Two nights for sure. One night the tent caught on fire. One night
the tent caught on fire, so that didn't help. So here we are. We're rolling dice to try and set up camp. We're rolling dice to try and do the resting thing, and it's just like we just kept screwing it up.
You guys got actually in real trouble. Like you guys were like kind of jacked up.
And yeah.
You had to like not travel for a day.
Yep,
like,
we had to spend a whole extra day just sleeping because we couldn't risk going out into the woods again.
So what happened was the first night, so Bob failed the roll and the catastrophe was fire. So like a big wind kicked up and part of the tent caught fire and they had to like run out of the tent without losing their gear and they took damage and whatever. But they couldn't sleep the night because it completely disrupted the night.
Yep.
So the next day they moved, they camped again. They rolled, they failed the roll, and it was flood. So I was like, cool, it rains, and it's like November. So it like rains, and where you put the tent is actually at a low point, yep. And like it starts taking on water, and you guys have to like break camp and like basically like hide up in trees for the night. And like you guys were so jacked that the next morning you went and made camp again, finally passed the roll and we're like, forget it. We're just sleeping. And yep. All they were trying to do was go home.
Yep.
They had finished their adventure and they were on a 2-day trip to go home.
Yep.
It turned into like a 4-day trip because of how bad it went.
It was comical.
It was really, and I mean, you guys were like real, like some of you were really low on points.
Oh
like,
yeah. I was 1 point away from breaking on strength and 1 point away from breaking on wits. And yeah.
Yeah. It was like, it was bad. Like I'm sitting there like, are they going to Oregon Trail this motherfucker? Like, is this campaign going to just like, are they just going to die of dysentery on the way home? Like it's possible.
That would've been terrible. So yeah, that was a thing. We finally did get home and then we did some of the paperwork part of the campaign with some bookkeeping and stuff. Still loving that game.
Me too. 28 sessions in.
Loving that nice. Game. Loving that game. Been watching some more summer hockey, which is still weird. But I love me some hockey. So I get a chance to watch some hockey. I enjoy it. And then I got inspired about, I don't even remember what spurred the conversation, but I dropped the topic on our RPG channel on Slack, in the Misdirected Mark Slack channels. And I said, hey, what would martial arts in a dwarven fantasy community look like? You know, because dwarves being short of stature and stuff like that, like what would their martial arts develop like? And then we had a conversation about that. And I was suddenly inspired. So I went back and I started hacking some notes together of a monastic tradition for monks specifically designed for dwarves from the mountains. And I've got it about probably 90% done. I've got a couple of abilities that I need to hash out what I want to do with and throw some fluff text in it just for giggles. And then I'll let some people look at it and see if it sucks completely.
I like that everybody wrote like really long answers, and I walked into the chat and I'm like, see Puck from Alpha Flight, done. Yeah. Yep. And like just walked out.
Yep. Was this inspired partially by our Eberron game?
You know, not directly, but I'm sure because we've been dealing with the dwarves a lot, and because I'm playing a dwarf, that it was in the back of my mind. So subconsciously, I'm sure it affected it. But yeah, something just spurred my.
It's a great idea. I love the concept of
Mercury. And I think I have an interesting mix of abilities and stuff put together with it. It's just a matter of whether or not it's balanced and, you know, uses enough things, use key points and different stuff like that. It definitely got flavor. It's dripping with flavor. So
I will say this, like PK Sullivan wrote some like really smart things about improvised weapons and all. And I'm like, I literally am just like the shit poster who walks in and is like, see Puck, and then like walks out like, sorry. I feel like it was kind of useful. Like go read some Alpha Flight. You see Puck. Puck's got some moves.
Oh, all right. That was me. What about you, Phil?
So still bike riding. I'm like 2 weeks into bike riding. I'm fucking loving it. I did just have a chat with PK today. I think I have to adjust my seat a little. It's not, I thought it was pretty comfortable and it is, but I'm kind of noticing something and I'm like, I think I need to angle this seat like down a little towards the front without being too graphic. But it just needs like a little, just a little tweaking. And I think I will finally have the seat completely worked out where it's supposed to be. But I'm building up my endurance for riding. So I've been like riding bigger and bigger loops through my neighborhood. And the way I know it's time to go for another loop is basically I do the ride and then I look at my heart rate on my Fitbit. So like, you know, if I push really hard, my heart rate goes up to like 144 or something. And as my stamina builds up, that number, like at the end of a ride gets lower, like closer to 100. So like it's coming down now as I'm doing this one loop and I'm like, okay, think it might be time like to, you know, bump out another loop. And I finally found where I want to ride to. So I'm going to go map it out and find out the distance on it and see if I'm like ready to do that ride yet or if it's like I still need to like build up some more stamina for it. Like
is that a certain park or
so there's that cool bike trail that runs through Tonawanda. You know the one, right? It loops so it runs past Lincoln Park and there's an off ramp from the bike trail that goes right into Lincoln Park, which for me would make it like a really nice loop that I would just come straight up Harrison, pick it up, go down the bike trail, jump off at the park, cut through the park, and then basically turn the corner and come home. Like it would make this really nice big square, which I like. I like just like, you know, I like riding in loops, for lack of a better term. So what I don't know, because I suck at gauging distances, is this loop a little bit bigger than what I normally ride? Or is it like a lot bigger than I normally ride? And if I go on it, I'm going to like die.
I think it's a lot bigger than the loop you normally ride.
I think it is. And I just need to see how much bigger it is, because it might be like ride half of it, take a break, you know, drink some water, then, you know, hop back on the bike and go again versus like, nope, you can't try that yet. Nope. So I need to kind of gauge that out. The other one that I really want to do is I do want to one day in the fall go hang out at the park by riding my bike down to the park. That's like another, that's a goal I kind of want to achieve at some point, but I'm willing to build up for that. Anyway, I've been riding my bike every day. Only one day when it rained, I couldn't ride it. I was kind of bummed about it. I kind of like reached the end of Minecraft this past season. Like we did that co-op thing. It turned out to be too good. We're all good when we play, but when we play together, we're like stupid. Like we're not stupid bad. We've solved almost every problem within like a couple weeks of the game. And I was like, oh, like I hit that achievement problem. So I'm playing this instance right now called, I don't remember the name of it. It's from FTB, Stone something. But you start in a stone cave surrounded by stone with like no items. And you have to like make dirt to grow a tree, to get wood, to like do all these things. So I'm digging around. What's that?
How do you make dirt?
You got to make a stone hammer, bust up stones into cobble, bust up cobble into gravel, bust up gravel into dirt.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm messing around with it. It seems fun. I'm going to do it for a little while until we kind of decide what we're doing for our next season. Cause as soon as I can do it with you guys, I like playing with all of you better than I like playing solo. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing that and reading Numenera. I read a couple comic books on Marvel this week that were really good. Oh, last thing, and I'll kick it over to you. I started watching the documentary on Netflix, High Score, which is like all about video games. And it's really interesting. There have been tons of documentaries on video games. I like this one. It's really interesting how they're approaching it and like who they've decided to focus on in different episodes. But it's like it's pretty nicely stylized, and it's got some cool 8-bit graphics they do like as in between stuff and things like that. And I just like the first one was like all about the rise of arcade games. The second one was all about the rise of the NES, which was great. And now the one that I'm watching is the rise of the computer RPG and like Ultima, like original Ultima and some of the Sierra games and things like that. And some pretty fucking crude Apple IIe shit. That would make Bob very nostalgic.
Yep.
But it's cool. I'm digging the documentary. It's fun. It's not like a complete and it's not a complete and robust timeline. It's just these slices that they keep taking out of different sections to tell different stories. And I'm okay with that.
That's okay then.
Cool. Jer.
Well, lots of Lego. I've been going through stacks of boxes. And this week I got a couple of small ones, and then my wife bought me a really big set for Christmas, and I just got around to finally digging it out. And just, I had to study for an exam this week for a certification, which I passed. So to kind of de-stress after studying for 6 hours straight, I spent like 3 hours just watching movies and building a Lego town set, which was really nice. Just, I like details. I find that it's given me back part of what I really enjoyed about building miniatures for war games back in the day. I never painted minis. I painted very few, but I love to kit bash, and that kind of fulfills that creative niche. And I'm finding it's a really good way to de-stress on a regular basis, which having not studied for a major exam in 15 years, 20 years, trying to get back into that mode for something where I was going to have to crash course, especially since they taught the class and then gave us 1 week to take the exam, and that's it. If you don't take it, you don't get to pass. So I had to, between work, fit in, you know, several hours of training. So it was something good. But I got to watch a lot of movies. I saw the aforementioned Knives Out. Following that, I decided to watch Logan Lucky, which was the Channing Tatum, Daniel Craig. I can't remember the guy who played Kylo Ren. And it's the best description is a quote from the actual movie, Ocean 7-Eleven. It is the redneck Ocean's 11. It's about three not too bright, down and out rednecks who decide to pull off a major heist. And it feels like Ocean's 11. There's flashbacks and there's weird setups and schemes and a bunch of stuff. It's a fun movie. If you like heist movies, if you like comedies, if you like Channing Tatum and Daniel Craig, I'd recommend it.
So this gets into like Fiasco Land.
Yes, very much so. Okay. Very much Fiasco Land.
Since where you're going with that.
Yeah. And then I watched Project Power, which people have recommended to me.
I saw that on...
my God. It's in a nutshell.
Watching?
Oh, my God, yes. It is a role-playing game setup. I mean, it's about a world where somebody develops a drug. You take the drug and you get a random superpower. When you get the power, it's always the same power, but it varies from person to person on what power you're going to get. But about 20% of the people who take the drug just blow up immediately. And if you only get the power for 5 minutes, then it wears off. And if you take too many doses in a row or take too many doses at the same time, you also may blow up. And what happens when the criminals start using these to take on the cops? And in a bad way, not in a mm-hmm. you know, positive Black Lives Matter sort of way, we're a bunch of drug dealing killers that are going to kill everybody. So it's a very cool movie. It's got Jamie Foxx and Joseph Gordon-Levitt acting their fucking asses off, pardon my French. I would recommend it strongly, and now I want to run a game in that universe. and the without ruining it, the logic behind the powers, where they come from and how they work is really cool. I also watched a horror movie from a couple of years ago called Ghost Stories that had Martin Freeman in it. And yeah, it was an anthology, and it's obviously one of these. Somebody had half a story for three stories in a row and then strung them together with a really bad ending. And I would not recommend it. It's a very slow burn that doesn't actually ignite. Every time something cool happens, they just stop the story and move on to something else. I wanted a couple of just little short things. So I watched the Thundercats reboot. I watched the first episode when it first came out, the one they put out like 3 years ago. And it was kind of interesting, but I decided on a whim, I wanted something to watch to kind of take my mind off of studying for an hour. And it's actually not a bad little storyline. I really like what they did. Episode 4 is just harsh, good in a good way, about a race of people that live and die in 24 hours. So it's heartrending. But if you liked the old Thundercats, this one kind of updates it and catches a lot of really good stuff with it. And lastly, we got to play some good games. Chris's D&D Eberron game has been excellent. We're now off the original storyline, and we're now adventuring with the dwarves, and we're in the middle of a war, which in Eberron is always interesting. And we're at level, what, 10 or 11? 10. So we're at the level where we can actually be effective even if outnumbered. So it's kind of fun because we're trying to, in true our type of role-playing game fashion, we have made allies out of people that shouldn't be allies or weren't allies. And we do a lot of negotiations, and it's just been a lot of fun. And lastly, we got our weird on with Dungeon Crawl Classics, which is just, I love DCC.
The Star Wound of Abaddon is a very strange adventure.
Funky. Yeah.
I don't normally like dungeon crawls at all, and I'm having a ball with DCC because DCC does dungeon crawl right.
I agree.
Yep.
Still my favorite third edition game.
Yep, definitely. So that was my week. Lots of Legos, lots of movies, lots of studying, and some good games. Cool. So, all right. So that's it for me. Bob, you want to give us some Patreon shout outs?
Yeah, let's do the shout outs and get into the ending so we can go after show. So thank you very much to patrons Joe Rosso, John, MT Black, Matthew Petrozelli, Michael Rollins, Padme's Lover, Robert Dorgan, Ryan Bolter, Texas Bento, and Troy Pitchelman. And thank you all for listening tonight.
Indeed, indeed. If you are free on Tuesday evenings at 8 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. the Queen's time, come join us live on Twitch, where you can chat with other listeners in the awesome chat room for life and ask us the occasional question.
If you can't make it to the live show, check out our podcast each week, wherever you get your podcasts. And take a listen to some of the other shows in the Mr. Mark Network, such as Down with D&D, Bone, Stone, and Obsidian, The FM Gamers, Panda's Talking Games, The Gnome Cast, John Who Hustle, She's a Super Geek, and Bonus Experience. You can and should also check out our sibling podcasts, The Tabletop Bellhop, Knights of the Night, and the always amazing Gaming and BS.
After you have broken the shrink wrap on your shiny module, and before you get it to the table, leave us some feedback. You can reach us directly via email at mmp@misdirectedmark.com. Check out us on the Twitchers. The show on the network is at Misdirected Mark. He's Robert M. Everson. He's GM Gerrymander, and I am DNA Phil.
If you like what we do here and on the other shows in the Misdirected Mark Network, you can support our Patreon campaigns. MMP, Down with D&D, and Panda's Talking Games are at patreon.com/MMP. She's a Super Geek is at patreon.com/SASGeek. Zhanghu Hustle is at patreon.com/Zhanghu Hustle. And Bonus Experience is at patreon.com/bonus experience. Patrons of MMP, Down with D&D, and Panda's Talking Games get access to the after show, pre-production show notes, musical parodies, the Panda's Talking Games bonus outtakes, and other special releases.
This has been a Mr. Director Mark production, the media arm of Encoded Designs. Mic drop!
We out!